59 degrees in Buffalo. The time 7:04. Good morning. I'm Jay Moran. This is WBFO News. The Lewiston businessman accused of setting up a torture chamber in his home pleaded not guilty yesterday in Niagara County Court to a 122-count indictment regarding just two of his alleged female victims. Ivor Fallon, age 67, was denied bail and has a tentative trial date of March 3rd. Congressman Brian Higgins says tax revenue is not needed to fund new parks on Buffalo's waterfront. With more, here's WBFO's Chris Kaye.
The Erie Canal Harbor Development Corporation plans to raise revenue from housing and commercial development to pay for parks on Buffalo's outer harbor. But Higgins says there's money available from the canal side project.
We'd like to see a minimum of $15 million in funding currently set aside for parking structures to instead be rededicated to outer harbor improvements.
Higgins says there's also no evidence that there's demand for 2,000 new housing units.
In fact, I would argue that the introduction of 2,000 new units would disrupt the great momentum that's occurring in downtown Buffalo with developers who have great vision turning old historic structures that have been vacant for many, many years into mixed-use development and residential.
In a written response, ECHDC Chairman Robert Joya said the outer harbor will not be financially viable unless it has a highly active year-round user base. Chris Kaye, WBFO News.
Buffalo public school children and parents are being warned of several separate abduction attempts. WBFO's Eileen Buckley says police have beefed up patrols outside Buffalo public schools, and the school district is ramping up awareness with students and parents.
The Buffalo Public School District is taking these attempts very seriously.
I think all of our students are feeling vigilant themselves. Word has spread very quickly.
Associate Superintendent for Student Support Will Carestis. City school parents are urged to know where their children are at all times.
Particularly before and after school, that students, when they're playing or traveling in their neighborhoods or communities, need to be with a friend or a family member. If students are approached by an adult that they don't know, by a person that they don't know, they need to run, yell, and tell.
Buffalo Police Commissioner Daniel Durenda says the hunt is on for the couple that's been driving in a white or tan color Lexus sedan, involved in four separate incidents outside of city schools since October 1st.
What kind of tips have you gotten from the public so far?
I won't go into specifics, but we are getting tips from the public. The investigation is progressing, but anything out there, we need to know about it immediately. And you need to make the kids aware. We need to be vigilant. We need people to stay on top of this.
The latest incident happened Monday when two 13-year-old boys say they were approached by a black couple in a silver minivan who asked them to get into the vehicle. However, the twist in Monday's attempt involved one of the suspects telling police it was all a big mistake. After questioning that individual and meeting with the Erie County District Attorney, police say no charges would be filed. For now, police are increasing patrols around schools.
Our school chief Kevin Brinkworth, has been in contact with the school district. We have extra patrols set up in and around the schools, extra patrols citywide.
Last night, the school district issued a robocall to all parents. A letter went out to school families last week, and another warning letter is expected to be issued today. Eileen Buckley, WBFO News.
The fourth annual TEDx Buffalo Conference was held yesterday. As WBFO's Ashley Hertzel reports, speakers touched on a variety of topics aimed at sparking change across the region.
12 speakers and two dancers took the stage at the 2014 TEDx Buffalo. The presenters discussed topics ranging from the intellect of digital assistants like Siri to the concept of the sharing economy to human and animal relationships. Speaker Dr. Kimberly Young is a clinical psychologist and professor at St. Bonaventure University. She talked about the issue of internet addiction.
We definitely have, I think, a problem with being too connected in our society. I make the point that at the family dinner table nowadays, we all kind of have our devices, and we're not really talking to each other. So it becomes more of a recurrent theme that we really kind of just live with this electronic noise. And so part of my message is looking at technology as a gift, but saying how can we be healthier about it.
The theme of this year's conference was In Motion. TEDx Buffalo director Adrian Birmingham says the gathering focused on people working to improve the greater community.
Last year we did Renaissance Citizens, and we had some excellent feedback. And one of the things that people said is that, you know, we're talking a lot about ideas, and sometimes it can be difficult to make the connection between the idea and the action. So this year we wanted to focus really on the action.
Birmingham says the goals of the event are to highlight what's happening in the community and to empower people to create and spread change. Conference proceedings are being shared online and via social media. Ashley Hertzel, WBFO News.
And later this morning, Erie County Executive Mark Poloncarz will present his proposed 2015 Erie County budget. We'll have more on that throughout the day here on WBFO. In sports, the Buffalo Sabres won their first game of the season last night, beating Carolina in a shootout by a 4-3 score. The Sabres now 1-3 on the year. Major League Baseball, Kansas City beat Baltimore 2-1, San Francisco over St. Louis 5-4. Forecast, some rain today, the high 65, chance of showers tonight, low 55. In Buffalo, it's 58 degrees at 710.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. Renee Montaigne is away. She will be back October 27th. The use of embryonic stem cells is changing. It's going from science that could someday help patients to treatments that actually do. Scientists are reporting the first strong evidence that human embryonic stem cells can help patients. In a paper in the scientific journal The Lancet, researchers report that cells seem to have enabled some people blinded by eye diseases to see better. It's a promising treatment and also controversial. NPR's Rob Stein takes us inside the operating room.
Good morning, Jules Stein.
It's early on a Tuesday morning at the UCLA Jules Stein Eye Institute in Los Angeles, and an elderly woman is getting ready to try something daring.
My name is Joyce, and I live in Lincoln, outside of Sacramento. And do I have to give you my age of 80? I just turned 80.
After we talk a bit more, Joyce decides she's okay with the age thing, but she doesn't want us to use her last name. She knows she's getting involved in something that some people think is morally wrong.
There are some people, because of their religious background, are a little bit hesitant at the use of stem cells.
And Joyce is afraid of being targeted by activists who object to this kind of research. But she hopes she can help scientists learn how to use human embryonic stem cells. She has macular degeneration, the most common cause of blindness in older people.
I have very low vision. I have struggled with it for several years.
She's not totally blind, but she can't see much. So she's had to give up all kinds of things, going shopping by herself, working at her church. But the hardest part is not seeing faces, especially her grandchildren. She tears up just talking about them.
I have five. I know, you know what they look like. I know the three older children, I know very well what they look like. It's just that I would like to see them more. And they change. We have a new baby in the family that's only 5 months old, so I don't see her as well as I'd like to.
So Joyce volunteered for a study to see if human embryonic stem cells could help her, or at least help other people someday.
When I heard there would be any chance at all, I felt even if it didn't help me, I still wanted to participate.
Human embryonic stem cells can turn into any kind of tissue in the body. So ever since they were discovered, scientists have thought that one day they might be able to cure lots of diseases. The study Joyce is volunteering for is the first that's getting a glimpse of whether that might be true. Later that day, Joyce is lying on an operating table surrounded by doctors, nurses, and technicians. She checks with the anesthesiologist to make sure she'll be out of it during the procedure.
I want you to know what you're doing, but I don't want to know what you're doing.
Sounds good. Sounds like a plan.
Once everything's ready, Dr. Stephen Schwartz, the eye surgeon running the study, gets started.
The lights out, please.
Lights down.
With the room darkened, Schwartz peers into Joyce's eye through a big microscope, hovering just above her face at the end of a mechanical arm. He delicately inserts three tiny tubes into Joyce's eye, including one he'll use to infuse cells into her damaged retina, cells that were made in a laboratory from human embryonic stem cells, 200,000 cells called retinal pigment epithelial cells. An assistant pulls vials containing the cells from a small red cooler so Schwartz can load them into a special syringe.
Okay, perfect.
He inserts the tip of the syringe into one of the tiny tubes in Joyce's eye and squeezes the plunger.
Keep going. Beautiful. Beautiful.
The cells are right where he hopes they'll take root, grow and possibly regenerate dead parts of Joyce's retina.
Stop injection.
After about 30 minutes, the procedure's done, and they wheel Joyce into a recovery room. Afterwards, Dr. Schwartz tells us it'll take weeks, maybe months, to see what the cells are doing.
Our hope is that she will be safe and perhaps contribute to our understanding of optimizing this procedure for future patients. And maybe in our wildest dreams, glean a benefit personally from this.
Wildest dreams, because the study was designed just to see if it's safe. The fear was that the cells would end up destroying whatever vision's left or morph into grotesque tumors. So Schwartz started with patients whose eyes were so far gone, there was little chance it would help or hurt.
We don't want to take a sighted eye or an eye that has really meaningful vision and blind it, which we could well have done.
So far, there are no signs the cells are dangerous. More than 24 patients have been treated, and some have been followed for almost 2 years. And something seems to be happening that Schwartz can hardly believe. In the new study, Schwartz is reporting that more than half of the first 18 patients have started to see better.
I'm astonished that this is working in the way that it is or seems to be working, and I'm very excited about it.
One volunteer got worse, but 10 could see a lot better. 7 others either could see a little better or at least didn't lose any more sight. And for some, Schwartz says, it's been dramatic, like an elderly rancher who lives in the Midwest.
He came in at a 6-month visit, took his hat off, took his glasses off, and started crying in my office. And he said, you know, I don't cry. I've never cried. And I can't tell you, Doc, how much this means to me, that I can take my horse out and ride my cattle and be on the land and be productive and be independent. That was pretty emotional.
One of the first patients to volunteer for Schwartz's study was Isabella Bukes. Bukes is out for a hike in a nature preserve near her house in Santa Rosa, California. Before she got the stem cell treatment 2 years ago, this would have been impossible.
In the past, it was hazardous. You know, I could fall.
Just walking anywhere by herself has been hard for Bukes for almost 40 years. She's 56 and lost most of her vision when she was a teenager because of a condition called Stargardt's macular dystrophy. But within weeks of getting the cells,
all of a sudden, things happen, and they couldn't believe it. And then my children were so used to walk with me, you know, to say, mind the step, mind this. And my daughter was with me in Los Angeles. And so she just burst into tears because she couldn't believe what I could see.
Bukes could make out the color of her clothes, see the cursor on her computer screen. Slowly, she realized she could find her way through crowded restaurants and even busy airports by herself. And today, she's hiking steep, rocky paths in the nature reserve.
I'm not scared of tripping anymore because, you know, I can actually see where I'm going. You see that, for instance, that stick that was lying there in front of us now? I could see it and avoid it, where in the past I would basically trip over it.
And when she looks into the distance, she can see the giraffes and other animals wandering the hills.
And I can see, for instance, these birds and stuff here, which I wouldn't have been able to see before. I mean, I can see the trees better, for instance. And I can see, you know, for instance, I can see the flamingos and stuff like that, which is different. It's more clear.
Now, Dr. Schwartz and others caution that the results still have to be considered very preliminary. After all, he's still only treated a relatively small number of patients.
I don't want patients to come into their doctor and say, hey, I heard about the stem cells on the radio, and I'd really like to get that treatment done, and what do you think? And it's not ready. Maybe in a few years, maybe not. We have to wait and see. The jury is way out still.
In the meantime, Dr. Schwartz is continuing to treat more patients, like Joyce, the patient we heard about at the beginning of our story. She's still waiting to see what her cells are doing. Schwartz has also expanded his study to Boston, Philadelphia, Miami, and London, and doctors are trying the cells on patients who haven't lost as much of their vision, in the hopes that human embryonic stem cells may prevent people from going blind in the first place. Rob Stein, NPR News.
And you hear Rob right here on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Morning Edition every weekday from 5 until 10 on WBFO. Good morning to you. I'm Jay Moran. Just ahead, we'll hear more about that story out of New Jersey where seven football players at Sayreville High School have been charged with aggravated criminal sexual contact with younger players. The controversy has forced that high school to cancel the rest of its football season. We'll have more on that. Also, Bob McCarthy in his weekly political conversation here on WBFO just after 7:30. Checking traffic this morning. Watch for some lane closures this morning on the 190 northbound. This is out in Niagara County near the vicinity of the Niagara Power Project as they continue to work on those bridges out there. And also, Dennis Road remains closed between Bennett Road and Lakeshore Road in Evans due to downed power lines.
Support for WBFO comes from our members and from Wester Subaru. 95% of Subaru vehicles built in the last 10 years are still on the road today. And Wester Subaru has a tradition of being committed to long-term customer relationships. Wester Subaru is located on Southwestern Boulevard or at westersubaru.com.
Not nearly as warm today as it was yesterday, but still on the mild side for this time of the year. Some rain with a high of 65. Chance of rain tonight, low 55. Tomorrow, starting off with sunshine. A chance of rain later, the high 65. And then cloudy on Friday with, once again, a chance of rain, the high 58. It is 58 degrees in Buffalo, 54 in Jamestown, 59 in Olean.
Support for WBFO is provided by our members and by the Niagara Wine Trail USA. The trail, open for wine tasting year-round, includes a combination of diverse boutique wineries just minutes from Buffalo and the Falls. More information available online at niagarawinetrail.org. The Niagara Wine Trail USA, where natural wonders are uncorked every day.
Well, it is time to say good morning once again to our pair of helpful folks this morning. Jim Berryman and Eileen Buckley, they're here to talk about membership.
Well, thank you, Jay, and good morning to all of you, our great listeners out there. And we here, of course, are in the midst of our fall pledge drive. You know, as longtime listeners to WBFO, we come to you a few times a year asking for your membership, your pledge of support to WBFO to keep the great programming on Morning Edition. 1-877-511-1017 is the number to call. We are in our next hour here of Morning Edition. We thank all those who called earlier. We made our goal last hour. Which is terrific because that means we didn't have to carry over that amount into this hour. Where we are right now, well, we have a goal of 10 calls to go in this hour, $1,200 to raise. Can you be a part of that and make this 7 o'clock hour your special part of your morning edition segment for you? We know it's busy. It's probably you're maybe perhaps rushing to get ready for work, school. Getting out of the house, that 7 o'clock hour is a pretty busy hour, so we would really appreciate it if you do have and can spare the time to call us at 1-877-511-1017 or go on your smartphone and pledge simply through the app. It's nice and easy and simple, and you'll be on your way.
It sure is. Well, I'll tell you what's compelling was that story we just heard about the stem cell. And again, a long-form segment of Morning Edition. You know, this is one of the things that I like to talk about how we can take in public radio, we can take and do a story like that in the morning. I'm sure you couldn't move. You're right, you had to hear the whole thing. That's generally what happens because that's the way this is set up. Compelling, intelligent news and information. You don't get that anywhere else. We have that ability to present this to you thanks to member dollars. And again, you know, I say that a lot, but it is worth repeating because it is true and it's what makes us. You know, it puts us on this level that we don't see very often, really, right? And so therefore, we want to maintain this. We want to be able to bring you this type of news. We want to do this on a daily basis, 24/7. You know, every time you turn on the dial, you're going to hear something intelligent coming out of your radio. Where else can you say that's going to happen? Very few places, right? Okay, member dollars do it. 1-877-511-1017. 10 calls this hour, $1,200. I have a feeling as we get through the morning, Eileen, that these goals will become a little bigger.
Always a challenge.
A little more robust, right, as they say. But we made last hour, it was 8 calls, right? This hour is 10 calls. It's only 2 more. There, you know, but there are probably more people listening right now. More people are awake. How many of us get up at 4:30 like we just did.
Just Jay Moran.
Jay Moran.
Even earlier than
he gets
that,
up at
right?
3,
oh,
I
my
think.
Goodness. But he's here because he's committed to
informing
you of the news and bringing you all the great programs that you hear on NPR and WBFO. We know you're listening because you do have that thirst for knowledge and that you're interested in all the world local affairs that are happening across our region and across the globe. And you love hearing all those different perspectives. And especially you hear that on Morning Edition. It kind of gets your day going because you feel informed and you have a sense of our local community and a sense of the world issues. 1-877-511-1017. Please consider a member support right now. At that number, you can make your pledge of support. 10 calls to go, $1,200. We don't want to fall behind. And that would certainly make a big difference if we didn't reach that goal this hour, this important 7 o'clock hour where you're getting your day started and listening to WBFO.
And all the good that comes along with that. Again, all paid by member dollars. 1-877-511-1017. We're kind of keeping this break a little short. We'll be back in about 10 minutes to update you on our progress. 10 calls, $1,200 this hour. We have many thank yous. They start at the $60 basic pledge level. Think about that one, folks. It's $5 a month. $120, can you do that? Get the member card, take another, you know, take your pick of thank yous. That's $10 a month. Maybe you want to talk to them about your volunteer here in the studio at 1-877-511-1017 about signing up for a long-term giving, right? Well, you do that every month in perpetuity until you change your mind, change the pledge level, whatever. It's up to you. But we have so many ways to make this happen. So easy. 2 minutes on and off the phone, back listening to Morning Edition. Looks like we have a phone call in there, Eileen, but we're going back. We got to turn it back over to Jay. We'll be back in a little bit to update you. Get to the phone, please, this morning. Support WBFO with your pledge. 1-877-511-1017 or online, WBFO.org.
Sayreville, New Jersey would rather be known for almost anything other than what the town is known for right now. It's an industrial city by the Raritan River. It has a history of making bricks and making gunpowder. Instead, Sayreville is known for a scandal, notorious enough that we need to warn you, you may not want children to hear this report, which is about 3 minutes long. Sayreville is trying to come to terms with allegations that teenage football players carried out hazing rituals that included sexual assault of teammates. Sarah Gonzalez, a member station WNYC, has more.
The Sayreville Bombers have won 3 sectional football titles in the past 4 years. They're a source of pride for residents like Tony Consolo and Christine Render.
Oh, they got a good team. They got a real good team.
I graduated in 1978 from the high school, and we still go to the football games.
They had some good teams. Yeah, they were pretty hot.
Just 4 games into this high school football season, Superintendent Richard Labby abruptly canceled the remainder of the season, freshman, JV, and varsity. At the time, he said it was because football players were harassing, intimidating, and bullying each other. He said it was happening a lot and that football players knew about it. His decision divided much of the community. At a school board meeting last week, parents and community members complained that punishing the entire team was an overreaction and that some of their kids' futures depended on football. That was before details emerged that the alleged harassment at Sayreville was sexual. Now, parents like Phelan Curry say protecting students needs to be the priority, not football.
I adore the program, you know, myself, but in light of what's going on, something needs to happen, and you got to stop and look at what you have before you can go on and move forward.
The state's primary print and online news outlet, NJ Advance Media, published a story based on a parent's description of a harrowing locker room ritual. Upperclassmen would allegedly make a howling noise, and the lights would go off. According to that parent, older team members would pick up his son, a freshman, and pin him down. The attacks allegedly involve penetration of a sexual nature. 7 players, ages 15 to 17, have been arrested for assaults on 4 members of the team. The charges include aggravated criminal sexual assault and criminal sexual contact, and hazing for engaging in an act of sexual penetration.
To me, hazing was what hazing was when we were in school.
Sheila Brown lives in Sayreville.
You threw a kid in the shower or you made fun of them or something like that. This, to me, is beyond hazing. It's beyond comprehension.
She supports the superintendent's decision to shut down the football program.
I find it hard to believe that the football team as a whole didn't know what was going on. And as long as that's the case, he was absolutely, absolutely right in canceling the season.
Outside of Sayreville High School, students are still wearing football sweaters and T-shirts in Sayreville blue and gray. Many say first figure out what really happened and punish the ones who are responsible, not everyone. They say it's not fair. It's unclear whether any adults at the school were aware of the alleged assaults. The state gets 30 days to decide whether it will pursue charging the seven teenage students as adults themselves. For NPR News, I'm Sarah Gonzalez in New York.
729. This is Morning Edition on 88.7 FM WBFO in Buffalo. In news this morning, a Niagara County grand jury has handed down a 122-count indictment against a Lewiston man accused of kidnapping and torture. Ivor Fallon pleaded not guilty during his arraignment yesterday. The Buffalo School District is taking the reports of abduction attempts near its schools seriously. Associate Superintendent Will Carestis warns parents to know where their children are at all times and that students should not be walking alone.
If you are approached by a stranger, you must run, yell, and tell. And if there is not an adult that you know, or if there is not a police officer nearby that you are able to flag down, then as soon as you feel you are safe, you need to get on a cell phone and call 911.
Last night, the district issued robocalls to all school parents. A letter went out to school families last week. Extra police patrols have been established in and around city schools. Though Election Day is approaching, the local races for Congress are getting little attention. In his weekly conversation with WBFO, Buffalo News political reporter Bob McCarthy says this year's races for Washington stand in great contrast to 2 years ago when Chris Collins ousted incumbent Kathy Hochul in a hard-fought contest.
My goodness, in all the years that I've been covering politics around here, we've always had competitive congressional races in Erie County even, but because of reapportionment, Jay, because of the way that the state legislature in Albany took the last census figures and created very, very safe districts for everybody, whether they be Republicans or Democrats, Republican Chris Collins, Democrat Brian Higgins, they are just seem to be cruising towards reelection this year. Down on the southern tier, it's a little bit different. You still have Tom Reed in basically a Republican district, but an unknown Democrat by the name of Nate Shinagawa came very close the last time, right? 52-48%. And that's what I think piqued Martha Robertson's interest right from the get-go. Like right the January 1st, 2013, she was practically launching her campaign. And so that's why it's gotten a lot of attention since then.
All right. So for her, it's been almost a year and a half of campaigning and raising some money at the same time.
Yep.
That being stated, there are some other things that are transpiring that don't look that great for her.
And that's mainly the fact that the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, the DCCC, had scheduled some broadcast ads on her behalf. They hadn't paid for them. They had scheduled. They had reserved the time, and they have taken back that reservation. That's always a sign that says they're not willing to spend the money on this race. They're going to take their money, spend it somewhere where they think they have a better chance of success. Now, that doesn't mean that this race is over.
Right.
It just tells you that one factor there that says that this is maybe looking Reed's way.
All right. Senator Charles Schumer was in town last week. He gave his endorsement in that 60th Senate district to the Democrat, Mark Panapino. I guess it's not a huge surprise to hear a Democrat push for a Democrat, but still a U.S. senator getting involved in a state Senate race, one that we're following closely here. Talk a little bit more about that.
Well, you're right. I mean, that usually when I have a bunch of Democrats getting together to endorse another Democrat, ho-hum.
Uh-huh.
But in this case, it does raise the question, where is Governor Cuomo on this? And that's because Governor Cuomo he's kind of been a little bit friendly with the Senate Republicans over the years, but especially Mark Grassani. They have developed a very close relationship, especially after Grassani was one of the four Republican senators who voted for same-sex marriage. And the day after primary, when the governor was here, he lamented the fact that Grassani had been defeated in the primary, and he blamed it on the hard right Republican Party that he says has replaced the moderate Rockefeller Republicans of New York in the past. So, but he nevertheless has not come out and said, I'm for the Democrat, and that's people are waiting for that.
And I'm curious about that, because there have been those who have said that the governor almost likes having that Senate Republican leadership there, that it might benefit him in a certain way politically, maybe not necessarily in New York State, but beyond. Your thoughts in general about
that? Yeah, I mean, especially the first 2 years of his term, he was very friendly with the Republicans in the Senate, especially when they were a true majority in the Senate. Now they are weakened and share power with the independent Democratic caucus, or they did for a while. We'll see what happens in January, because they have said they might hook up with the Senate Democrats again. But we'll see what happens, because there's always these shifting coalitions there. But it does allow him to kind of go down the middle, especially on a lot of the fiscal issues that where he has been. He has veered to the left on a lot of the social issues with same-sex marriage and expanded abortion rights that he would like to see in the Women's Equality Act, and with the SAFE Act, the gun control law. So, you know, they do kind of work hand in hand sometimes, and that he just doesn't seem to be real enthusiastic the way that Mayor de Blasio has been in pushing a left-leaning Democratic Senate.
Very fascinating, for sure. We've got a couple of weeks going to Election Day, and of course, we'll be talking with you every Wednesday morning. Bob, as always, thanks.
We'll look forward to it.
Yes, so Bob McCarthy of the Buffalo News is with us every Wednesday during Morning Edition through Election Day here on WBFO.